Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Ben Fife joins us today from New York. He is a vice president at the Growth Equity Division at Goldman Sachs, better known as GS Growth, where he leads growth stage deals on their application software team and is focused primarily on industrial technology. Prior to joining GS Growth, Ben was an investor at GSV Capital. And prior to that, he began his career as an energy banker at Credit Suisse. The GS Growth team has a strong track record in industrial technology spanning LlamaSoft, Locus Robotics, NYSHEX, Project 44, and TraceLink. Ben, it is certainly the appropriate time to bring my go-to industrial growth investor guy on the show to help us make sense of everything going on right now. So welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks for having me on, Ty.
Right on. Well, I always give a short summary, but give us more of that color commentary on your journey and what led you to GS Growth.
Yeah. So I actually started as an energy banker actually out in Houston, which, you know, despite you know, someone from the Northeast ending up in Houston, you know, doing oil and gas, there is a longer story there, which I'll spare the audience. But it was a great place to, you know, learn, I would say, the language of finance and become fluent in it. And also gave me some great insight into how some of the industries or more legacy industries did business, which we'll get to later, but I think it's actually appropriate and for the world of industrial technology. That being said, I was always interested in technology, fast growth, and to a certain extent, you know, volatility, as weird as it is to say, and, you know, we're feeling, I think, both sides of it now. And I wanted to get out to San Francisco. And so I moved out to San Francisco, broke into VC by working at GSV Capital, which was a great experience. But I think I wanted to, you know, get to more of a place where I was, you know, leading rounds and bringing a lot of value to the entrepreneurs who I worked with, and got to Goldman Sachs Growth Equity about 4 years ago. It's been a great journey and been a great experience.
Right on. Well, you may or may not have seen a little bit of industrial during your time at Houston. So it's a great background to start into all of this. So and maybe help us just set the stage a little bit for the listeners. Tell us a little bit more about GS Growth generally, and then about the fund mandate.
Yeah. So our growth equity team sits within the broader asset and wealth management division at Goldman, which is where all of our private investing activity is. So we have a large private equity team, we have a large real estate portfolio, credit team, et cetera. And I sit on the growth equity team. So the growth equity team has been making the growth stage investments for about 20 years, traditionally off of our balance sheet. And we've invested almost $13 or $14 billion over that period of time. About 2 years ago, the team decided to raise an outside fund. So we raised a $5.2 billion outside fund with outside LPs. And, you know, we're writing $30 to $150 million checks in growth stage business. We got 75 of us on the team, with, say, a little more than half of those sitting in New York or San Francisco, and then the rest spread across Europe, Asia, Latin America. So truly global team, which is great both from a learning experience, from, you know, helping our portfolio companies expand, given we have, you know, local institutional knowledge basically in every local geography. I think really just trying to invest in businesses that have strong product market fit and need help scaling.
Right on. Well, we're going to talk more about that value add later from the platform, and I'm going to keep trying my best to get you guys to have a presence down here in Texas with all the industrial stuff going on. So I'll keep working on it. But let's kick this off here with a go-to growth market expert as my guest today. I have to start with the obvious question: the current state of growth investment. So if you read the macro headlines, there is a lot of doom and gloom out there. While VC deal activity dropped in all stages and sectors in the first quarter of 2023, according to the latest PitchBook and NVCA Venture Monitor, highly recommend to our readers, listeners, late stage deal value in particular continued to decline in Q1, dropping for the seventh straight quarter to $11.6 billion, marking the first time that quarterly deal value has fallen under $12 billion since Q4 of 2017. And in Q1, we also saw only 19 mega rounds. Those rounds is defined as 100 million or more, which, to put in perspective for our listeners, there were 98 mega rounds completed just a year ago in Q1 2022. So clearly the appetite to write large growth checks has fallen off the cliff, per se. But that said, that is just what the numbers say. Ben, take us behind the curtain. What's your assessment of the growth market right now? And tack on what you're now looking for in deals to cut that growth check. And maybe I'll end by saying I don't need to see another Bain private equity report with all the dry powder stacked up on the sideline for private markets. You guys you're not going to just shut down shop and not do any more growth checks. So just give us more color on what's actually going on here.
Yeah, I think it is the confluence of a lot of factors, which some of which I'll try to hit, and a lot of which I think won't be new to all of the listeners, but hopefully there's at least some degree of insight in what I have to say. So I think, you had this period over, 2020, 2021, and 2022, where a lot of investors, I think, thought their deployment cycle was a lot, faster, or the fundraising cycles were a lot faster than I think they ultimately are turning out to be. So instead of, raising a new fund every 4 years, people thought that they could start to raise a fund, every 2 years. And, that's not that dissimilar actually to what happened with companies, where they thought, instead of having to raise a round every year to 2 years, they could raise a round every 6 months, which increased the pace of deployment. So I think what you saw over 2020 and 2021 was actually more over deployment and not, and actually probably less normal than probably the pace of deployment that you're seeing in 2023 and probably into 2024. So now you have a lot of funds who thought that that need to stretch a fund which they thought they were going to deploy over 2 to 3 years into 4 or 5 years, which led to a period of probably 6 months where you saw a lot of people not writing checks. That being said, people do still have to invest. Our job as investors is to deploy the capital that we have. And
of course,
I think the way that, we think about investing at Goldman is not that dissimilar than how we have always thought about growth investing. We are in the fortunate position that we did not really over deploy in 2020 and 2021. And we've maintained a pretty consistent pacing over, I would say, the last 3 years, albeit maybe slightly slower at the beginning of this year. And the way that we think about it is, how do we generate, a 3 to 5 times return on our capital over a period of 5 to 7 years? And, part of that is investing in great businesses with great founders that can grow efficiently top line. And part of that is ensuring that you get in at a price that allows you to make money, or that type of money, when you exit. If you break that down, then it's not that you are getting in at whatever multiple you think you're going to exit at, or whatever you think the appropriate public market comparable is. It's getting in at a price where you can grow through that multiple. So for example, if software companies trade at let's just say somewhere between 6 and 10 times revenue today, and that's what we think we're going to exit at, how long is it going to take you to grow into that multiple? And then how long can you compound with that multiple? So if you get in at 20 times, it might take you 2 years to grow into that multiple. And then you compound at, let's just say, 50 to 60% for 3 years. And that's somewhere between a 20 to 30% IRR for us. And I think that is, attractive entry point. The other piece of it is the company going to make, good use of your capital? In other words, if I invest, $1 in sales and marketing, am I going to get some multiple of that return on my capital? And so if my, cash payback is 3 to 4 times on investing $1 in sales and marketing, then you should continue to burn capital. And if it's not, then you should not. So a lot of what we look for is efficient growth. The analogy we always use is, it's very easy to get to 100 million of ARR if you, sell a dollar for 75 cents. And I think in 2021, you saw a lot of companies doing that. And so, like most investors, were really nailing in on what truly is efficient growth. I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it was, who was it? Bill Gurley and Brad Gerstner were, you know, putting all these charts up there on the All In Podcast Summit. And it was, multiples didn't just fall off a cliff. They just kind of came back to normal from whatever we saw in 2020 and 21. So getting back to normal, I think I hear is a theme, Ben, and you guys certainly had the patience to play it. So maybe with that general setup, let's narrow in that discussion layer in the context to the focus of this podcast, industrial innovation specifically, where you guys have a great track record. And so the last several years of data show that industrial innovation tech investing has exploded on a relative basis. Again, according to PitchBook, let's just use a few examples. Logistics startups have had VCs commit roughly $5.6 billion just last year into the enterprise supply chain management startup category, a nearly 120% increase from 2017. And warehousing tech, a space you know well with Locus Robotics, saw venture investors commit $2.8 billion last year, a 326% increase from 2017. And even construction tech has seen a ton of new investment and new company launches, with an estimated $50 billion invested in AEC tech between 2020 and 2022, which was 85% higher than the previous 3 years. So a lot of data there, but clearly a lot of money going into these industrial sectors. So to use an industrial pun, clearly the foundation has been poured, so to speak. And now everyone's wondering, though, how will the growth capital show up given this current environment we just discussed, and, you know, especially for some of those business models that maybe have a hardware and or a CapEx component? So all that buildup, what impact do you think the current growth conditions we just discussed will have on this ecosystem, if any? And share with our audience what you're seeing the best companies in the ecosystem do to recalibrate to these current conditions. You know, even how are you advising your own portfolio per se?
Yeah. So I think the focus and the money pouring into supply chain, I think, is great for the ecosystem. You know, to a certain extent, a lot of what it means to scale a supply chain business, particularly in the technology sector, is building up a reputation and credibility as an early stage company to really support the mission critical processes of your customers. And that requires a lot of trust and also belief that you're going to be around. And I think the media attention and certainly, you know, the balance sheet that some of these companies have enabled them to really scale and give confidence in their customers and actually grow more efficiently than they otherwise would be able to. So that is all to say that I think it's great that all of this is happening for anyone really who cares about the ecosystem. And it's great for me because, you know, as you people like you start to invest more dollars into that ecosystem, there's more opportunities for me to deploy capital. And that's great because that's my job. You know, I think from an investor perspective, though, particularly at the growth stage, you know, in supply chain, I think one thing that I've learned and taken away over, you know, the last few years is it's a lot about solving a particular pain point for an individual customer, and it's a lot about the application that you've built. So there is, you know, you see a lot of companies who have focused on you know, broad machine learning or broad platform product, and, you know, to a certain extent it makes a lot of intuitive sense for why supply chain executives or supply chain managers would want to adopt that type of technology and why it's an upgrade over the current product set that they use. But the reality is that's not really how the buyer persona works. And, you know, there's, I like to say, a lot of gotchas in supply chain, in the sense of the best technology doesn't always win. And sometimes inefficiencies exist for a reason. Whereas in, you know, I'd say like the developer ecosystem, the best technology usually does win, and adoption of new technology and disruption cycles are very fast. Whereas the opposite is true in supply chain. So all of that said, the advice that I give companies, and if you want, we can dive deeper onto the hardware side, because, you know, Locus obviously has a hardware component as well, and how I think about creating an enduring moat in hardware. But just on the company management side, I think you know, the macro doesn't change a whole lot in terms of what you should be focused on. I think as a company, you should be focused on every dollar you invest generates real return for you. It doesn't need to be hard ROI and hard cash on cash return, but there is, you know, ultimately the purpose of your company is to sell software, sell product, and everything you should you do should be in the with the goal of selling more of those systems. And to a certain extent, that could mean investing in building trust of your customers and doing unscalable things early. And so I think, you know, focusing on the problem that you're solving and making sure you have really happy customers who will be references for you as you scale is probably the most important thing you can focus on right now. As it relates to having a hardware component, I think, you know, the things that I always think about is, you know, there are hardware companies that have scaled and have created big businesses and don't really have a big software component to it. You know, ultimately, those businesses, in my opinion, compete on speed of delivery and price. And so, you know, trade at much lower multiples than businesses that do not compete on speed of delivery and price and have some enduring software moat or some other moat. So if you're a business that is a hardware business that does not have a big software component, I don't think that that's a bad thing. I just think it means you have to understand the type of business you're building and how those businesses scale. And, you know, not all of those are appropriate or would be benefited by venture capital dollars. I think if you know, the great thing about a business like Locust that I one of the reasons that we invested is they did a great job at inserting themselves into the workflow of their customers, both from a software side and actually just an orientation of how people do work within a warehouse. And that creates, in my opinion, a scalable moat because the system gets smarter as it grows. And there's a real, you know-how, which means that in your next facility, you know, you'd much rather bring in a robotic system and execution software that you already know versus, you know, something that maybe looks similar but has a different workflow associated with it. And so I think that's, you know, for anyone who's building a hardware company that wants to you know, hopefully trade like a software company, then I think it's both about just your margins and to a certain extent just what your enduring mode is. And so I think thinking about how to create, you know, workflow stickiness is a good thing to focus on over a longer term.
Absolutely. And, you know, to your point of, you know, understanding the customer's buying persona, understanding the domain technology is not going to overcome those trust built relationships over years and years. I mean, again, just use Locust as a reference. Always, they showed up to ProMat, Modex, Automate, all the conferences we all go to, Ben, and, you know, across the ecosystem are known as a group that definitely listen to the customer, what the customer needs. And I think you guys just announced like a massive 5,000 unit deployment with DHL. I think that's all publicly announced now. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it speaks to your point, right? You can build a heck of a moat if you listen to the customer and build that trust up. So kudos on that one. And, you know, maybe, you know, these first two questions, we're all watching the capital markets more challenging, all the things we talked about. Obviously, still massive opportunities when you roll up all these industrial sectors. It's half the GDP, millions of skilled laborers kind of sort of need to get this right, regardless of what the capital markets are doing. So I want to move us forward with the tone. And now let's flip it and say, how can we, and challenge the investor groups, how can we step up to add real value to these founders that are going through that? And so Goldman Sachs, clearly a storied financial powerhouse with breadth and depth across sectors, geographies, financial products, operational, et cetera. I could go on. It's understatement of the day. And so I know the answer via you and I having our back and forth looking at different things, but share with the audience why startups choose to partner with GS Growth and how your team curates and tactically delivers, you know, a value across all these vast resources and expertise that you have at Goldman Sachs to support the companies that you're investing in. Would love for you to share that with the audience.
Yeah. Happy to. This is, you know, and this is what I do all day. I sell money. so
sell away, Ben.
I'll give the sales pitch for the commercial on GS Growth, which is great that I actually believe in it. But I think the most important thing that we do and orientation that we have is that all of our investors really have, you know, need to have buy-in that every single one of their companies succeed. And, you know, that, and for us, the way that that happens is that each of our investors make 1 to 2 investments a year. And so at any individual time, each investor has 4 to 7 companies in their personal portfolio. And so they have real career risk on each of their investments. And so that means that each investor is willing to do unscalable things to ensure that that their investments are successful and that to ensure that they ultimately have a good track record. For us, you know, the types of resources that Goldman has is, you know, sometimes harder to navigate, but easier to navigate from the inside, and helps you, and you can push in the right places if you do have the right type of motivation and risk and willingness to, you know, again, do unscalable things. And so, you know, Goldman has a number of operating partners who I would say spend, you know, real time with our portfolio companies. We have, you know, the previous CRO of SuccessFactors and Marketo, who goes in and helps build go-to-market functions for our portfolio companies. And, you know, he's not, I would say, flying in, giving a 30-minute speech and telling people to, and then, you know, telling you to call him and he'll get back to you in a month or two. He's working with 4 to 5 portfolio companies and working, you know, 50, 60 hours a week, which, you know, at his level of success, I don't know if I'd be doing the same thing, but, you know, it's great that we have people like him on board. We have the person who built Azure at Microsoft as a technical advisor. We have the former CMO at Intel and Cisco. And these people are motivated to work and really, I'd say, help our portfolio companies. In addition to that, we have bankers who have connectivity to every global 2000 CEO in the world. You know, our bankers make potential customer introductions or partnership introductions all the time, not just because they eventually want our portfolio company's business, but because they have a vested interest in our fund doing well. And, you know, a lot of times we've built personal relationships with those bankers and have done them favors. And so they, in a certain sense, owe us and do actually step up to the plate and make a lot of introductions for us. We have, you know, 9,000 engineers who can be advisors or customers to a certain extent. We have a large private equity portfolio. It has a number of companies that can be customers. We have a real estate portfolio. We own a bunch of industrial assets, and we know those tenants, and we know that market. And then I would say, you know, the other, you know, it's a softer way that we add value is, I think, to my earlier point about building trust with your customers and supply chain and how it's so important, I do think the Goldman brand carries more weight in supply chain than it does in some other industries. You know, if you're selling into a supply chain executive in the Netherlands who works at DHL, they definitely know who Goldman Sachs is, and I don't know that they know who maybe other growth or venture funds are. And so those are a few of the ways that I think about adding value on behalf of Goldman. And the most important of that is really just helping out and being there for your portfolio companies and, you know, almost in a certain sense, asking or offering that menu of options and seeing what people want.
Absolutely. And it's my jokes aside about selling. I was very excited for you to get on here and share the story of all the value you can bring, because you mentioned earlier, you're needing more of us downstream to help fund these early stage seed stage companies so that you have more to look at down the pipe. We can't even try to come close to offering the types of resources as they need to scale globally, let alone all the other things you mentioned. And so we need more folks like you guys jumping in to help. It takes an entire village to get these companies where they need to be. So, and maybe I'd tack on a quick sub question. Yeah. Any standout examples of how you've connected dots, you know, to the point of all the value you've just discussed that you want to call out, and or associated to that, maybe more importantly, how do you, you know, translate between the language of a massive, you know, Goldman corporate and what you're doing as a growth stage venture guy? You know, how does that work in practice as well?
Yeah. So there's obviously, or not obviously, but you know, Goldman has our restrictions and compliance standards. So I'll avoid saying too much on all of the inner workings, but you know, I think translating or understanding the types of value that you can bring to your company, to the company that you're speaking with, to a certain extent is requires you to really understand the company at a very deep level. And so, you know, we do a lot of diligence and speak a lot to our companies before investing to understand what type of value we need to bring and have them meet a lot of aspects of Goldman and, to a certain extent, make customer introductions in advance of investing at certain times to just demonstrate the type of value we're going to bring. And that's kind of how we translate it. To get to a specific example, you know, and keep on coming back to Locus, but given the industrial focus and given where I've spent my time, probably just the easiest example for me to pull on. We've done a few things since we've invested. First is, you know, I mentioned we have a number of different divisions we have relationships with, prospective customers. We have our bankers, we have our private equity portfolio, and we have our actual private wealth division, who covers a number of the C-suite executives of all of these large corporates that Locus could sell into. And so we've made, I would say, maybe 10 plus customer introductions since we've invested. You know, at a certain point, we're making, I think, one customer intro a week. And, you know, these are two very, very large corporations that I think everyone on this call would know and recognize pretty easily. And then we've also introduced them to certain channel partners and just broadly other executives in the industry that could be helpful as they think through certain strategic problems that arise as companies scale internationally. The other piece we've done is, you know, I mentioned our 9,000 engineers. We have a very strong data science function, and you know, some of the thought leaders in just building and scaling data infrastructure organizations. And so we have one of our top data science engineers speaking with the company on strategy and scaling and team building and just how Locus can further utilize a lot of the data they collect to further optimize the workflow of their users, which is something I talked about earlier. And then, you know, lastly, we brought in a bunch of our operating partners just to really, you know, Locus is a big organization that, or I wouldn't say big organization, but is a scaled company that to a certain extent needs to just continue doing what they're doing. So you don't need to go in and really change anything. But there are a lot of people who have good experiences who can be good advisors to them and partners and be sounding boards for any of their executives. And so, you know, I took the train out, she flew out to Boston. Karen Walker, who was a former CMO at Intel and Cisco, who I mentioned earlier, and sits on the board of Eli Lilly and Sprout Social. And we spent a full day with their whole team just to go through, I would say, every aspect of their go-to-market, as well as just team management stuff. And you know, that was a 4-hour session, and then we went to dinner after. And you know, and she's now, let's say, catching up pretty regularly with 3 to 4 of their executives, and has her own independent relationship with them. And so I think, you know, that's maybe a soft dollar ROI in the sense of, I don't know how that's going to show up in the P&L, but it certainly helps and is appreciated. You know, and then some of those customer intros, you know, that's hopefully translates directly to P&L value add. And so those are some of the things we do, but again, it varies pretty dramatically by company that we engage with.
Right on. Well, incredibly powerful platform. Again, an understatement, and absolutely love the point about trying to make some introductions before you ever invest, right? Because you're going to get diligence back and forth, and founders out there listening, it's, you know, put the investors to work long before financing is what I love to say, because I can guarantee you Ben's going to show up. I know our shop's going to show up to try to help you. Anyway, I just love that point of it, Ben. It translates growth stage or early stage. So,
yeah. All right. I think the other point is, you know, do your work on the investor before you know, they invest in your company. It's a lot easier to get someone on your cap table than off your cap table. And so I think that speaking to people who they've worked with in the past is incredibly impactful. And, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable sharing some of these stories on the podcast if I didn't think that, you know, our portfolio companies would support everything that I've said.
I agree. Shotgun marriages of 2020 and 2021. It's going to be quite interesting when you pick your partner in that 2-week cycle. So yeah. C'est la vie. We'll see how it plays out. All right, Ben, we always love to bring the show at the tail end here back to the founders in the arena. As we just talked about, words of wisdom you give them as they're approaching GS growth. We always love to split any keys to success as they kick the chat off or common challenges to avoid as they get things going.
Yeah, I think it's some of what I mentioned earlier, which is establishing a relationship early. I think, you know, from our perspective, it's great to spend, you know, time with the founder, them get to know, us get to know who we're investing in. You know, ultimately you're investing in a company and a market opportunity, but really you're investing in the people and the founders to execute on that vision. And, you know, there's any number of problems that arise post-investment, and you know, really it's up to the management team and the people who you invest in to deal with those problems. And so I think establishing that trust and that relationship over a period of time, I think, is important for us. And I think, you know, having, you know, to a certain extent, you know, being humble and understanding that your business will establish or will have problems, and not promising the moon and the stars or early on is just probably a good way to go about doing things. You know, I don't want to advise anyone to do anything that's unnatural to them. And to a certain extent, you know, to be an early stage founder, you need to, you know, have that, you know, that level of optimism. But I do think for us in particular, you know, it's something that we love to see is just founders who understand their industries and understand that things take time and to a certain extent are demonstrate that they can be a good partner to us. And then, you know, outside of that, you know, approaching us is not that dissimilar to approaching any other investor in that, you know, you want to have a strong understanding of your business and your market and the problem that you're attacking and you know, really all of the things that go into building a great business. And then having the metrics and, you know, story to back it up, you know, in a certain sense, you know, the way I do things, and I joked about being fluent in finance earlier, but to a certain extent, reading financials is almost like reading a language, and what you read in the financials should translate to the story that you tell. And I would say it's when you tell a story and then, you know, you get a bunch of financials that don't match the story that you said, you know, that's a little bit jarring versus being upfront and, you know, demonstrating or telling the story early on of here is what our numbers are. They are what they are. And here's why. And that's going to be okay. But, you know, I think trying to hide or not be transparent in the way that you communicate is just for us a little bit of a flag.
Absolutely. All great advice. Well, we always wrap up here a little section we call quick hitters. So some rapid fire Q&A. If you're ready, Ben, we'll jump in.
Let's do it.
All right. Number one thing you're looking for when evaluating a founder within this ecosystem.
It's a deep domain expertise. I think, you know, supply chain is a difficult industry. And if you really don't understand your customers' pain points and workflow at a very intimate level, it can be challenging.
Couldn't agree more. What is one resource? Could be a book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend our audience to follow in the ecosystem.
So aside from this podcast, which is really the only place you can really go to understand supply chain, I personally love the Founders Podcast. I think is really a very good way to understand some of the journeys that these founders have taken and some of the lessons learned.
All right. We'll check it out. One person who should be on the podcast.
To talk my own book, I will say my brother, who is the CEO of a company called Bright Feeds, which is turning food waste into animal feed out in a manufacturing plant in Berlin, Connecticut, and soon to be scaling.
Right on. It's called Bright Feeds?
Bright Feeds. B-R-I-G-H-T. Feeds.
All right. The Fife family coming in strong here in the tech community. I like it. And then finally, the best way for folks to reach out to you?
They can email me at ben.fife@gs.com.
Great. Well, Ben, thanks for giving us a little view into the growth stage world for a little bit. And we've got a lot of work cut out for us ahead, and I'm certainly going to be sending more up your way to be a good partner. So appreciate you coming on, and we'll find something else to work on soon.
Excited to work with you, Ty. And thanks again for having me on.